Hello and welcome to Playback Daily for Monday, the 10th of June. I'm Louise Herity and here's some of what's coming up.
This is the first time I've ever toured on a motorbike. And it's all part of a culmination of a midlife crisis.
Very few female victims, and then all of a sudden I come parachuting into Ireland and the first thing I'm faced with is a double murder of these women, these vulnerable women. Horrendous.
When I was getting a bit boxed in there, I thought, oh my God, I have all the legs left but nowhere to go. I didn't grow up playing camogie to get boxed in though, and look, I want to thank everybody who has helped me get here today to win my first senior gold medal for Ireland.
In between all the coverage of the local and European elections, comedian John Bishop offered a bit of light relief. He's on the last leg of a 3-week motorbike tour of Ireland, and he joined Áine Kerr, who was in for Brendan O'Connor on Sunday.
You've parked the bike. You literally just took off the biker jacket here in studio. The bike is downstairs because you've come from Wexford via Tala this morning. Is this how you always travel now? Motorbike in?
No, this is the first time I've ever toured on a motorbike. And it's all part of a culmination of a midlife crisis, I suppose. So I decided to tour on a motorbike, and I decided I wanted to do it in Ireland because I wanted to do the Wild Atlantic Way. So that's what I've spent 3 weeks doing.
And why the motorbike? How did the inspiration come from doing that versus, you know, a nice scooter or travelling by car or running?
Well, because as I say, it's a midlife crisis. So it was a motorbike or a 25-year-old stripper. So I thought the motorbike would be better.
Your wife was very firm.
Yeah,
yes,
the motorbike seemed the cheaper option. No, in all honesty, I've never been interested in riding a motorbike before. And then my father-in-law died and left me a scooter, but he left it in Brittany in France. So I had the idea of bringing that back to England, which I can't do now because of Brexit and all of the complications of that. And then, so I end up taking it to Barcelona on a ferry to Mallorca, where I've got a place. So that ride was the inspiration, because I'd never been on a motorbike, you know. So I was basically...
So you were a learner driver doing your test at some point last year, were you?
Exactly. So I rode all the way through France in the Pyrenees, dressed like I was nipping out for a baguette, because I had none of the proper gear. And I met some fellas on big BMW motorbikes, and I thought, that's what I want to do it properly.
And so you've got the gear now, as we can see, and you've got the motorbike. And so you decided to do Atlantic Way. You've been all across the country. I think you've called it a love letter to Ireland. So you've been Belfast, Derry, Letterkenny, Belmullet, Limerick, Killarney, Clonakilty, Cork, Wexford, Dublin. I think I've covered everyone
in
there.
You missed Clifton.
Oh, right, in Clare. Beautiful. Yeah. What's been the highlights? Like, what a way to travel and see this country. And you've probably even gotten some of our rare sunshine.
It's been amazing. The last couple of weeks, the weather has been fantastic. I've seen Irish people sunbathing in Ireland. I don't think anyone's seen that for a long time.
Yeah, we get a glimpse of the sun and it's barbecues out and shorts and we go
so
for it.
So it's been, because obviously on the west coast, the beaches, the area is beautiful to see. And to ride on a motorbike through some of it has been breathtaking.
And what's the experience? What's different about experiencing a country like this, but on a motorbike?
Well, for a start, and I have to say this, your roads are brilliant.
Oh.
I mean, honestly, you've got
parts of the country will disagree,
I'd say to them, go on the M25, because honestly, you've got potholes everywhere in England, and it's the roads are fantastic. I love the fact that you've got a road, and next to the road, you have that spare road as well. You have that little yellow dotted line, just in case somebody wants a bit more extra road. So you've got that. The network's fantastic in terms of the way it's all linked up. And I think from an experience point of view, when you're on a motorbike, you're more exposed to the environment. So, you know, there's good and bad in that, obviously, in Ireland. So there's a few wet days, but it's just, I don't know, it's just a different world.
Were you conscious of elections happening here over the last while you were travelling around?
Oh, cool. Well, we're across the border and I saw all the heads, all the faces on the lamppost. To be honest, my first impression was Tinder in Ireland's rubbish. And then
you were adjudicating all the candidates.
I was just looking at them, and then I thought, and then I realised that it was the election. Then I looked at them and thought, I can't. You got no sense of anyone's policies, just that they've got a head.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you want to be in politics in Ireland, your first qualification is have a head and then get a photograph of that head and then put it on a poster and that's it. If people like your head, you're in.
So very different to how you see it going down in the UK. And what about Irish people's sense of humour? And like you've been to Ireland many times over the years, but is there something uniquely different about Irish audiences and the stories you tell? How you tell them, how they resonate with an Irish person?
You know what? And this is honestly true. And this is why this tour has become a love letter to Ireland, because the reality is that I kind of made the decision to be a professional comedian from doing gigs in Ireland, just because my style of comedy is anecdotal, it's storytelling. And the like, you know, Irish people have always... They want you to have a story and they want you to have a song. And I can't sing, so I've got the stories. And that's...
And you've taken to taking the bike onto stage as well, just for...
Oh, I did in Cork. I did the marquee in Cork, you know. The night before, I'd done the Barras in Clonakilty with 150 people in a pub. I never took the bike in there. But
is it hard to execute taking a bike on?
The marquee in Cork has 4,000 people in it, a big stage. And in my head, it was a brilliant idea. Until you're doing it and it's full of 4,000 people. And as I come on, I thought, this will be on the news tomorrow. One little slip and I've become Evel Knievel.
You pulled it off, though. Looked pretty smooth.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You did the gig afterwards. You talked there about, you know, making your break in Ireland. Before, of course, you got into comedy, you worked in pharma sales. I think technically you've still been longer in pharma sales than you have been a comedian.
It's crossing over, yeah. I was in pharmaceuticals for 17 years.
Wow.
And I left my job at 14, 57 now, so I'm 17 years now as a professional comedian.
And is there anything applicable from pharmaceutical sales to life as a comedian? Any crossover skills, strengths?
Travel. Okay. Travel, that's it. Travel and that's about it, really. There's not, because the job that I did was very specialised. We used to sell a drug to stop people rejecting their organs after transplantation.
Okay.
And not very funny.
And you, over time, though, decided comedy was going to be for you. And I think a lot of listeners won't know how you came to fall into comedy at age 35. Will you bring us back to the story of, you know, you're going through a tricky period in your life, I seem to recall, separated from your wife at that particular period, and these kind of lonely Monday nights and how to fill them?
Well, that's it. That's basically it. I split up with my wife and then I had the kid because of the job that I had, because I was travelling all the time. I couldn't guarantee when I could have the kids in the week. So I had them every weekend, which meant Monday was a depressing time. So I was always looking for something to do on a Monday. And to cut a very long story short, I ended up going to a comedy club and I went because I thought I'd go and watch comedy. And when I got to the door, the guy said, it's an open mic night. And I genuinely didn't know what open mic meant. And he said, that means that if it's £4 to get in. But if you put your name down and you're prepared to go on stage, you don't have to pay. And I was getting divorced. So I thought, well, that's £4 she's not getting. So I put my name down, thinking it'd be 200 people in there. Because I'd been to two comedy clubs in my whole life to that point. And I walked in and there was only 7 people. And my name got called out second.
And the 7 people in the audience were also probably trying out as comedians.
Five of them had put their name down. And I remember, and this is no way of a lie, my life would be different but for a 15-minute window, because my name got called out second after a guy who got on stage just doing... just chicken impressions, just basically saying, if you've ever seen a chicken drive a van, bah, 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 bah,
you think you would have chickened out if you'd been further down the list?
No, I was just, no, I'll be honest with you, it looked like care in the community. I thought, I cannot believe these people are here. And then my name got called out and I walked on stage. I'd never been on stage before in my life. I didn't have a joke in my head. And I remember standing there thinking, what am I doing here? I thought there's only seven people. But, you know, if I go back, I'm going back to an empty house. And then I thought there's only seven people here. And one of them thinks he's a chicken. So I might as well just stay. And I just started talking. And I remember as well, the light flashes when your time's up in stand-up comedy. I didn't even know that. I remember saying, oh, your light's broke because it was flashing. And I just carried on talking. They ended up playing music to get me off because I was just talking about getting divorced.
And so, yeah, you just made it about real life.
Yeah.
And it resonated with the audience.
Yeah. I mean, when I came off, there was a... the compere was a great comedian called Mick Ferry. And the fellow who run the club said, you know, where have you been doing your comedy? I said, I've never done it anywhere. Because I was meant to do 7 minutes, I think. I did about 35 or something. And he said, you know, you should come back and just do it. Just it's somewhere to go on a Monday. Just come back and do this. He said, because some of the stuff you were saying was funny. He said, the bit where you spoke about getting divorced and you started crying, don't do that. He said, that's not as funny. But the rest of it, just come back. So just built up from there.
And you kept coming back and honing the set, and then I think you got an opportunity to a main act couldn't do it. You got pulled in and you went to do your act and you realised you had an interesting member in the audience.
Well, yeah, I used to do, I'm trying to work out if this is appropriate. I used to do a joke anyway about splitting up with my wife and then knew I was going to miss it, so I kept the head in the fridge, which is a terrible joke. But I was on stage, I've been caught. Nobody knew I was doing it. I never told any of my friends. I never told anyone I was doing it. It was like my little secret. I didn't tell my mates till I'd been doing it for about over a year. Because when you start off, you're not listed on the lineup. Nobody knows your name. You know what I mean?
It's underground, yeah.
And then I got a phone call to say someone had dropped out. And it was a midweek, so I didn't need to get a babysitter. And I went and I said the same joke about the head being in the fridge. And then I looked and the head was in the audience. And my ex-wife was there. And we were just... In England, when you get divorced, there's a decree, nice eye, it's probably the same here, and then a decree absolute, and there's like 6 weeks between them. So your divorce papers are in, and then the absolute is when you've just finalised everything. And we were at that stage, and we weren't seeing each other at all, and I saw her. She came over to me at the bar afterwards, and I thought, God, because when I saw the head, I thought, oh, that's going to cost me another 20 grand. And then she came over and just said that, she was just said it was great to see her. She said, you've got that little twinkle in your eye again, like the man I met. She said, I don't know what happened to you. I said, I married you. That's what happened. And then she just said, do you think we can do something? And do we have to do it this way? And then we started going to Relate, which is like marriage counselling, and got back together.
So you finding your spark, your energy, your calling in comedy also helped you find your way back to your wife and to each other.
Oh, got my family back. I owe comedy more than it'll ever give me back.
And you're married now, how many years?
30 years now, on and off. But
and kids and happy.
Yeah, listen, we are lucky to have found each other, but even luckier to have hung on.
And one of your biggest fans through the years in the audience was your mum. And I know last year she passed on, and you had put up at the time this lovely video of her in the audience watching you perform in Mother Goose. Was she a bit of a character? Did she have your sense of fun and comedy?
She's interesting. My mum seems to be, it's my mum's side of the family that's got the biggest Irish connection. And this whole tour show that I'm doing now is both a love letter to Ireland and a love letter to my mum. And I didn't know it was going to be either of them, because I don't write my comedy down. If I'm not performing, I don't sit at home writing jokes. I kind of live my life, hope something funny happens, hope I remember it, and hope it's funny when I tell people. So doing a tour means I just do loads of little gigs and stuff evolves. And what's evolved is this union between the two things. The people of Ireland reflect the way my mum was. She was just funny, friendly, or it's just, yeah, like everyone's mum, you know what I mean?
And you had three boys.
Yeah.
They used to be part of...
I don't have three boys. I've got three fellas. Okay. It's three men. I own three men.
They've changed through the years. Geez.
Yeah.
Have they changed you?
Have they changed me?
Yeah. Fatherhood. Did it change you through the years as they go from childhood into teens
if
into 20-something?
If I was to do anything now, if I was to have three wishes, the first wish is I wish I could have them again. I wish I could have them as young children now, because I'd be a better dad now, because I know more. That would be my first wish.
What would you go back and do different?
I just think... I think I was a young dad, you know, and I knew less about the world than I thought I knew. And also men are more, I'm definitely one of those examples of men being more emotionally in tune than I was. And I think, you know, men don't say I love you very often to a son. If I had a daughter, she'd have been told that every day, but with a son, you don't know what to do, so you just, like, give him a dead leg or something, have a little wrestle, you can. And I think those things I would be better at now than I was when I was younger.
And you had to go through a lot with one of your sons, if it's okay to ask. I think it was only later in life he got diagnosed with an issue that basically causes deafness over a period of time. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you've kind of learned and grown alongside him as you've learned more about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, we did a documentary about it and it'd never been spoke about. And like a lot of things in families, when you, particularly if you're in the public eye and your role in the public eye is to make people laugh, when other stuff's not going on well in your life, that's not... what that doesn't get shared for obvious reasons. Also, it's private, and also it's not you. You know, your children have their life, and so it's not your role to tell the world what's going on with them. But he lost his hearing when he was 16, and he didn't lose it completely. He's lost 75% of it. It fluctuated up and down, which was very difficult because the fluctuations meant that you couldn't get a benchmark of where to treat it and so on. Anyway, it's sort of settled now that he survives with hearing aids, and we ended up doing this documentary where I learnt enough sign language. We learnt sign language together because he doesn't need it if he's got hearing aids in. We learnt enough sign language together so that I could do a gig to an entirely deaf audience in British Sign Language.
And as much as he was having to kind of figure out this at age 16, how much for you did you have to adjust and readjust and relearn and rethink even your relationship with your son?
And you never stop doing that. Have you got kids?
You have daughter age 6. Yeah, it feels like she's going on 16 most days of the week. Yeah, constantly evolving. So,
but your relationship with her will be different in 4 years' time when she's 10. Than what you think it'll be now. And it'll be different in 10 years' time when she's 16. And it'll be different in 20 years' time. It never ends. And like, you know, my oldest son now, Joe, is 29. And we're probably closer now than we were when he was 16. But when he was 16, he probably needed me to be closer to him then. But I just thought he had a problem. And my job was to try and fix the problem, not ask him how he felt about it. And so we've learned all of those things. And I think as a parent, the biggest challenge is to do the right thing, but also make the person that you're trying to do it for understand why you're doing that. And sometimes that means doing nothing.
Yeah, and they just feel the love, the loyalty,
yeah, just feel the love.
You had your own health scare recently. You came through it in terms of cancer. Was there, you went to your GP, they took a look at something, you did have this whole moment of contemplating life. Not a period of kind of being, having maybe, a test and the test came back. No, maybe not.
No, what I did, this was a long time ago. I haven't had any cancer scare or anything like that. No, a long time ago. When I say a long time ago, I'm talking, must be 10 years ago now, I had a persistent cough. And in the UK, if you've had a cough that doesn't go away for, I think it's 12 weeks, they send you for a chest scan, a chest x-ray. So I had a chest x-ray. This might be what you're referring to. I didn't think I've really spoke about it, but a chest x-ray. And my GP, and I got an all clear. And then about 6 weeks later, the GP phoned me up and said, look, there's been a problem. Can I see? And I went in and he said, they gave you the all clear by mistake because there's shadows on both your lungs. And he said, you know, that's not good if that's the case. So he said, go, you'll have to get a scan. So fortunately enough, I was able to go and get a CT scan. And what they found out, that is, I've got calcification in the middle of my chest, which means at some point I've broken my what's that part? Your rib cage, mm-hmm. the middle of your rib cage. I can't remember what it's called, but I've broken that, and it's rehealed and calcified to a big lump of
your sternum,
bone.
Yeah.
But it looks like a shadow when you put an X-ray on it. Anyway, that period between getting told that you've got something that looks like it's fatal to afterwards was a few days, and I tried to keep it to myself, but because Melanie knows me more than anyone else, she knew straight away, and we went for this thing together. And it's nothing like a lot of people go through, but it was a period of time where you do start going, am I actually, if I was checking out now, is it okay? Have I done enough? Am I leaving with a settled bill? And it was definitely a time. And I suppose it's led to all of these things, like me thinking, right, I'm now going to learn how to ride a motorbike. I'm going to go touring in different places like America. And I'm going to soak the most out of the day that I can.
So you go through something like that, come out with great health the other side, of course, and you recontemplate and,
But also, I've always tend to be positive. And this is not one of those dramatic things where someone's been through something. You know what I mean? It was very, very mild compared to what other people. It's just that if the prognosis was what the X-ray suggested, then it wouldn't have been very good at all.
What about getting old? Not getting old, but getting older. Like, you're doing the motorbike tour. You did the book, How to Grow Old. Are you enjoying just these later years getting to do things on your own
terms? I saw a thing the other day, like everybody else now, you pick up your phone and you scroll through something. And Jane Fonda was talking. She's brought a book out, apparently, about feeling better when you're older, because you all of a sudden realise that you life has thrown enough stuff at you for you to know that you can get through it. You know what I mean? You've learned enough and you think, I'll get through this. And so you learn that and you can see all the positives. And also you get bold enough to spend time with the people that you want to spend time with. And so I'm enjoying getting older, apart from the fact that I want more of it.
And more of it and more of Ireland hopefully means you're coming back in October, having done the Atlantic Way. What's up next here?
Well, October, when I come back in October, it will be for this tour, because we've just not been able to have enough tickets for the people to come and see it, because it's gone brilliantly and it's very Irish-centric. And then next year will be 25 years from when I did my first ever gig, so I'm going to do a celebration tour of that as well. Okay.
Comedian John Bishop chatting to Áine Kerr on The Brendan O'Connor Show on Sunday. The big talking point in sport after the weekend was the Irish success at the European Athletics Championships in Rome. Darren Frell had an update on Morning Ireland.
Yeah, isn't it lovely, Mary, to come in on a morning like this and to talk about the athletics and Ciara Magee. And I think I've probably lost track of the amount of times that we've come in here and spoken about her competing at a weekend where things didn't go to plan for her, but last night they certainly did, and wasn't it worth the wait? European 1500 metre champion, gold medalist last night, a brilliant, brilliant run in Rome, second gold medal in 3 days for Team Ireland. And I want to put that into perspective, because before the weekend, it was only Sonia Sullivan was out there on her own as the gold medalist, 1998. We've had to wait a long time, and then two to come like that is just terrific. And really held her nerve in the race as well, especially on that final bend. I think we'll all remember that final bend forevermore. She squeezed her way through two British athletes and hit the front. If you didn't see it last night, we'll play some of the commentary and you'll get a feel for it. Greg Allen called them home.
But a little bit of a boxed-in situation here, and she needs to find a gap. Can she find a gap? She needs to burst her way through. She has burst her way through, and Ciara Magee is in the gold medal position, and George Bell is fading, and Guillermo is fading, and it's going to be Ciara Magee's gold medal. She is doing it. She is adding gold to the silver and bronze, and gold it is.
Do you know what?
that. Words can't even come close. I've been... everybody back home knows how long I've been doing this and how hard I've been trying. And I've had so many times whenever I've come off here and I've not felt quite the way I am today. I went out on that track today, super nervous, but with a plan and with a mission, and it was to hear her on the vein. And when I was getting a bit boxed in there, I thought, oh my God, I have all the legs left, but nowhere to go. Yeah. I didn't grow up playing camogie to get boxed in though. And look, I want to thank everybody who has helped me get here today to win my first senior gold medal for Ireland, to be at the top of the podium, to hear our national anthem, and to show world athletics that the Irish are here, and we're here to show where we belong.
There you go. Love that
reference. Camogie stood to her.
Portaferry.
Nearly in tough, tears here, Darren, listening to that.
Tough breed up there. It goes to show you, doesn't it, how the sports cross over. Certainly needed that little kind of get out in front of your marker last night. Sarah Healy, her first major final, 7th place. Brilliant for her as well.
Darren Frehill there on Morning Ireland. And well done again to Ciarán McGeehan and to Sarah Healy. On the Oliver Callan Show, presented by Maura Duran today, the host was joined by former state pathologist Dr. Marie Cassidy, who recalled when she first came to Ireland back in 1998 and there was no time to waste.
I mean, I hadn't even decided I was staying. I mean, I'd said to Jack Harbison, I've come over and have a look about the place. And he was always very, well, maybe I'm very busy and I'm doing this. He didn't want me to see the squalor he was in Trinity. And I said, right, I'm coming over. And Jack had known for years and years. And I thought, he's not there at the airport. And then these guards came and said, are you Dr. Cassidy? We're here to take you to a crime scene. And I said, really? Gosh, this is quite exciting. And off I went to the Grange Gorman. And that sealed the deal for me.
Yeah, and it was a very brutal murder, of course, of two women,
horrendous.
Sylvia Shields and Mary Callan. And how did you feel when you arrived to see this? Because I know it really impacted on you, because I remember reading that in your 26 years at that stage as a pathologist in the whole area, that you felt it was so gruesome, one of the most gruesome murders you had ever seen.
It really was, because I'd come from Glasgow, I remember, and that was gangland stuff. So there was the stabbings and we were beginning to see shootings coming in. But it was all mainly male victims, very few female victims. And then all of a sudden I come parachuting into Ireland and the first thing I'm faced with is a double murder of these women, these vulnerable women. Horrendous.
Yeah. You've written a lot, you've spoken a lot, you've talked about women being murdered, of course, even your RT documentary as well, which is really, really good. There are an awful lot of women that have been murdered in Ireland over the years. Of course, a lot of unsolved murders too.
Yeah, I know, it's horrendous. And it took even the Women's Aid to produce this list for me to even realise it, because I'm just busy going from one case to the next and I'm not really racking up the numbers in my head. And then when I saw it down there, and then I was beginning to read through the names and I was thinking, oh, Jesus, I remember that. Oh, I remember that. Yeah. Oh, and I'd forgotten. And that really stabbed me in the heart. And I thought, I've forgotten about these women. Everybody had forgotten about these women. And we just sort of packed it neatly in the background and thought, yeah, well, it'll never happen to us.
Yeah. And it's interesting then that as women, we are huge consumers of true crime. True crime novels like the one I'm holding here, Your Body of Truth, of course, has just come out in paperback. And again, the genesis of this book as well, it's based around a woman being murdered in the Phoenix Park.
Yes, yes.
Remind us of the story.
Well, the story is it's a female podcaster who is interested in true crime. They always say write about what you know, and I know nothing but death. I mean, that's
well, it comes true in the book as you're reading it.
My job for 40 years, I don't know anything else. I really wouldn't be very good in Mastermind, because that would have to be my topic.
I wouldn't be surprised if there would be an area on this, considering it's so huge right now.
It's incredible. So anyway, she's a female podcaster.
Terry
O'Brien.
I shouldn't say. Anyway.
It's maybe a part of my personality. I think she's either the worst of me or the best of me. I'm not
Terry
sure.
Terry O'Brien, So a female podcaster gets murdered in the Phoenix Park.
And Terry O'Brien, who has recently arrived in Ireland from Scotland,
yes,
is sent out to have a look at the body and take over the case. And then it all spirals out from there because Terry O'Brien is not exactly a toe-the-line pathologist and tends to perhaps delve into areas that she shouldn't.
It's interesting, when I was reading the book, she was one of the Garda Éire said to her that she was, or the doctor said to her, oh, you were on gardening leave in Scotland. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen to you. You just came here.
No, I just decided, let's just go to Ireland for the fun of it.
Yeah. And why? Did you just feel that Scotland, you wanted to change, or how did you end up here?
Yeah, I mean, I came into forensics a long, long time ago in the 80s, and I'd seen the changes in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. And our Glasgow department, when I'd come in, there was three of us, and now there was five of us and six of us. And as a forensic pathologist, it's a terrible thing, but you'd like to be busy. And the more people that were coming in, you were seeing they're going out at the weekends. And much as I hated being on call, you know, as soon as I got the call, I was out. Like yourselves, you know, you live for the next thing that's coming in. And I'd got to the stage where it was getting very samey, and I thought, Jack had said to me, how do you fancy coming over? And I went, yeah, why not? We'll give it a go anyway.
It's interesting. Just reading as well, though, about the description of Terry and the scrutiny she's under because of how she looks in the book.
Yeah.
Like, how did you feel about that scrutiny?
I mean, I found it very intrusive. I didn't understand it because in Scotland, you know,
everyone's glamorous like you.
Nobody knew we even existed, because I would get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning and I would go out at 3 o'clock in the morning. So everything was done under darkness and nobody even knew. We were at this underworld because, people died. Something happened and a hearse drew away and a body disappeared, but nobody saw all the activity in between, whereas it was front and centre over here. So all of a sudden you were becoming part of the story when that had never happened before.
And you had column inches written about you as much as the murder you were covering. It's funny because, you know, we talk a lot about if it was a man, you wouldn't have that scrutiny on you. And just because, you know, you were well turned out and you had your makeup on, all of a sudden, you were the story. Did it bother you?
At first it did. And then I just ignored it. And I just thought, you know, everybody's got a job to do. And the people who are reporting have got a job to do as well. And as long as I don't interact, because I made the mistake one day of standing at the tape at the crime scene and chatting to the photographer that I thought was the Garda photographer. And then when the guard lifted the tape and said, come in, Doc. And I said, are you coming in? And he went, oh, no. I'm with whatever.
Was it a red top? Can I ask? I
probably
know him.
I won't give a name.
Of course you won't say it. Was he good though? I bet he was getting information out of you.
He got very good photographs, put it that way.
Oh my goodness. It's very interesting. But when you think about our crime writers, you've got like great writers like Liz Nugent and Alex Barkley here and
I know.
But they wouldn't have the insight that you have. And I remember, I think it may have been Lee Child, who I interviewed recently on the Today Show. And I think he said he actually interned almost with the police in the UK to find out what it was like to actually go into a morgue and do the autopsy.
Mm-hmm. And going back to that, I mean, I can remember, again, as a baby forensic pathologist, suddenly you would have these crime writers, because it was just beginning to become the in genre at that time. And I can remember one of the crime writers, the Scottish crime writers, and she'd phoned me. She said, I'm doing this book and it's about, you know, it's very police procedural, but we've got a death. And I said, come on into the mortuary and I'll show you a post-mortem. You wouldn't be allowed to do that today. I mean, and so over the years, I've become very friendly with a lot of the crime writers, because they come to me to say, this is what we want to happen. I always say, well, what do you want to happen to the person? Do you want them to die quickly or slowly? Or do you want a lot of blood? What do you want? But they don't actually, they get, you know, sort of second-hand, third-hand accounts. And that's why in this book, I deliberately made it very factual about what happens in the mortuary.
Which
and
is great.
What happens, because it's not, since murder is awful and it's violent and it's horrible. And I'm not going to sensationalise it by, you know, using very graphic language. I'm just going to tell you exactly as I would do when I was writing a report myself and giving evidence in court. It's just very matter of fact.
That's why this is real. because you are probably one of the only people who could write something like this from the inside, not from the outside looking in, yes, from the inside looking out. And that's what makes this a very real book. Cold Cases, of course, you know, she is, Terry, your heroine in the book, is immersed in cold case files in the book.
Yeah.
And is that something that you yourself were always very interested in?
It's one of those areas where it's a shame because with new technology, we can go back and review cases, particularly with the advances in DNA. So it's not the pathologist or the pathology that, you know, is going to solve anything, but it needs somebody to look and say, that's a case that it might be worthwhile revisiting. And it's become a big thing now, but it takes a lot of time, a lot of energy and a lot of money.
I mean, you think about Operation Trace and, of course, the missing women. Yeah. Excuse me. And over the years, so many different investigations and various fresh eyes have been put on it in the Gardaí during the years. But still, yeah, we can't find out. We can't get much further than we did when Operation Trace was set up. Mm-hmm. In your own opinion, do you believe there is one person that committed two or three of those murders?
Do you know, it's one of those areas that I have kept away from in a way. I mean, it was always there to the fore because any time there was a bone found or something or potentially a body being found, immediately that was the guard. He would go, maybe we'll found one of these ladies. So it was always there in the background. But I always tried to keep away from investigations that I wasn't really part of or involved in. I didn't want to come in afterwards and go, well, you all got it wrong. You know, you should have been doing this. You should have been looking there. Instead, I was just looking more forward. And it's funny, even with the Sophie Duplantier case, which was, I was the knee-jerk reaction to that because suddenly they'd realised that Jack Harbison couldn't cover the whole of the country. And you know, be effective. I always stayed well away from it up until such time as now that all the core people have gone. Yeah. And then it's time to sort of look at it and go, yeah, that's very interesting, that case. Yeah.
No, I know what you mean with your eyes on it. I know you say you like nonsense, like myself. There's nothing like nonsense to take us away from reality. And I think as a woman, we need loads of nonsense in our lives. And in nonsense, you're talking about glamour and glitz and Dancing with the Stars and all that. Is that why you did it? That you just wanted to do something different?
Exactly. When I decided to hang up the scalpel, I had no idea what was going to happen next. And I mean, even writing the memoir was a kind of just somebody contacted me and said, would you fancy doing it? And I thought, oh, I'll give that a go. Mm. And that's my attitude just now is, yeah, that sounds like that could be fun. Oh, that sounds interesting. Let's just give it a go. But I do love a lot of nonsense. I like to fill my head with nonsense. I used to have to try and, because of the horrors of my day, I had to go home at night and fill my head with nonsense to just sort of clear it out so I could start again the next day.
Yeah, and that's actually very important because being a pathologist, a state pathologist, or working in the area of crime or courts and all that, mm-hmm. I found myself, you can get very hard very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be very much one way and your mind mm-hmm. can just decide that everything should be like this and tough. So in order to kind of make yourself a little softer, you keep the feminine side. Do you think that's why you decided to do very different things?
Yeah, and I think even in my professional life, as you're talking about the red lipstick, you know, as I always say, you have different personas depending on what you're doing. And going, as soon as I get up in the morning, I put the lipstick on in the high heels and I became Dr. Maddie Cassidy, state pathologist. Take them off, I'm just Maddie Cassidy who sits in the house eating a load of rubbish, watching rubbish on the television and just living a normal rubbish nonsensey life.
I'm so happy to hear that. I think our listeners will too.
Dr. Mary Cassidy chatting to Maura Duran on the Oliver Callan Show this morning. The Fragrance Foundation Awards, the Oscars of the perfume world, took place in New York on Friday. And to discuss all things scent and the perfume industry, Maura was joined by Sarah Halliwell from The Gloss and Sadie Chowan from Burn Perfumery.
It's a huge industry.
It's really huge and it's just getting bigger and bigger. I mean, in the years that I've been at The Gloss, it's been kind of every year it's just got bigger and bigger, and I just get so many samples sent in to sort of see the whole breadth of the industry. So, yeah.
Well, I love the fact that you brought in. I was rattling upstairs this morning with my bag with my own perfumes in it, and I see now I am just looking. I just want to dive across to take a look at some of those perfumes you have in. Shall we just go back? I mean, you're looking at about 5,000 years ago when the whole perfume started, and probably Mesopotamia, that whole mm-hmm. area, and coming through.
Yeah.
But when did we become so obsessed with perfume in the Western world?
I mean, it goes way, way back, you know, and icons, obviously, you know, you've got Marilyn Monroe talking about wearing number 5
and nothing
in
else.
Bed. Yes, that's kind of a big perfume story. But I mean, it goes way back further than that. You know, the pharaohs kind of being buried with their favourite scents. And,
yeah. And I suppose when you look at kind of Dickensian times and Victorian times, mm-hmm. People used scent, and of course in France and everywhere as well, because we didn't have great hygiene. You know, we had open sewers. So scent was to kind of mask the smells, the horrible smells around
us. Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, like Mary Cassidy was just talking about putting on a persona, I think a lot of us use perfume, you know, as part of our day and as a part of our persona. So like putting on a red lipstick to be brave. You know, you might put on a different kind of perfume to make your mood different or make you feel different.
And, you know, that is so true. And we all love different scents.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel myself, and you probably feel the same as me, at different times you want to wear, you know, maybe someday if it's a lovely, beautiful sunny day, you might wear a floral scent. I tend to wear more woody, earthy scents in the winter time, depending on my mood.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think you just, you know, something can give you a real lift. If you wear something sunny like neroli, like Sadie, who's going to be on the line, has done a wonderful neroli perfume, which is really just full of sunshine and just gives you that lift and radiance. So I think, yeah, it can absolutely have an impact on your mood and how you feel.
When we go back in time and we talk about, say, Chanel No. 5, mm-hmm. it was probably the first perfume that used ingredients made in a lab to make it perfect.
Yeah.
Before that, I mean, the perfume world could have seemed a bit cruel in the sense that you'd have to get to create musk, you'd have to kill a lot of deer to take the musk from the anal glands. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But they have obviously they don't do that anymore, and they've changed what they use and what they're allowed to use. But I think, yeah, Chanel No. 5 is interesting because Gabrielle Chanel didn't want to create a flower as such. She wanted to create an abstract scent. So she was very ahead of her time in that way. You know, when she was creating, and this is 1921, she was creating No. 5. So, you know, that really...
And it became this almost earthy scent. When you talk about smells, I always wonder about, you know, different parts of the world and the scents they're into. I mean, I know certainly in the East, they like these heavy scents, whereas in the States, we like the smell, or they like the smell of clean linen.
Yeah, that's really true. But interestingly, at Brown Thomas, one of their biggest, most popular scents now is an oud. One of the Frederick Malle ouds has become really popular here. It's become their top seller in their range. So I thought that was interesting that kind of influence is coming here as well.
It is. I'm actually spraying here in studio now Burberry Goddess. And this was the winning scent in the Fragrance Awards at the weekend. And this is what they call a gourmand scent. Can you tell us a little bit about gourmands and vanillas and what they smell like and why we're into them now?
Yeah, I mean, it's become a massive trend. We're seeing there's a brand called Sol de Janeiro that's absolutely flying out of stores because they do a super sweet kind of it sort of smells like salted caramel, you know, so you're getting I mean, super sweet. But I think for me, I think it goes back to COVID a bit because I think we all wanted sweet treats. We wanted small comforts. And I think we're finding those kind of smells really comforting. I think there's other variations on it as well. So you might get a kind of almondy smell, or you might get there's a scent called pistachio that's really beautiful. So they're all very delicious kind of almost edible smells. But I do think that's kind of shifting as well to kind of skin scents. So scents that smell very kind of intimate and close to your skin. So they're kind of, they might have a sweetness, but they're maybe not so overpowering and kind of sickly.
Okay. We will bring in our perfumer. We have Sadie Chowan on the line with us. And as Sarah just said there, Sadie, you've just brought out, of course, you're from the Burn Perfumery down in County Clare. Lovely natural place to be and lovely natural ingredients surrounding you. And I know that's echoed in a lot of your fragrances.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. The last fragrances that I've created have been certified 100% natural. And that and organic. And that's really because I love the natural ingredients. There's such a wealth of them, and they come from all over the world, and it's just discovery after discovery. And I think there is a rising interest in these precious ingredients, as well as in the perfumes that are created with them. And coming back to what you were talking about earlier, I think women are feeling just empowered and celebrating their individuality. And I think that's one of the reasons that they're more adventurous. We're all more adventurous now in the perfumes that we wear, and we're ready to explore different perfumes and wear different things at different times of year on a different mood.
I suppose that creates
opportunity for niche perfume houses and companies.
We have a listener getting in touch. Can you ask the perfume expert what scent she would recommend for someone who is very sensitive to scents? I just keep sneezing. 51551, by the way, is our text number. Do get in touch, because we'd love to hear your stories about perfume and what it evokes in your life. So your perfume would be good for someone like that, wouldn't it, Sadie?
Yes, we do have a lot of people who are generally very sensitive to strong scents, and who react well to natural scents, which can be much gentler.
Very good. Yeah. What do you think about oils? One of our listeners are asking, rose oil fragrance. Is that the strongest? Is oil the strongest, or the how long it lasts? Does that depend on the type of perfume, whether an eau de toilette is lighter than an eau de parfum?
I get asked this question a lot. So yes, an eau de cologne would be at about 10%, and then an eau de toilette would be a little bit stronger. It would be blended at about 14%, say, and then an eau de parfum would be about 16%, and a parfum would be at about 20%. But it doesn't just depend on the strength of the blend. It also depends what's in it. For example, vanilla is incredibly strong. Sandalwood. These are all base notes. So these would stay on your skin for many, many hours. In fact, sandalwood for several days. Whereas the top notes, which are all citrus, say bergamot, grapefruit, bitter orange, all those wonderful fresh notes, those are the first things that we smell when we open or spray a bottle of perfume. And those are the first to disappear as well. They're very volatile. And then the middle notes, or the heart notes, are all the things like rose and lavender and a lot of the herbs. And those would be the heart of the perfume, and those would stay on our skin, depending on the ingredient and on our skin, for maybe 4 to 8 hours. So it depends on the ingredients in the perfume, also on your skin type. So what I think is wonderful about perfume is that they smell completely different on every single one of us. So I can spray a perfume on myself, and then I can smell it on your skin and on your skin, and it's almost like it's nearly a different perfume.
This is interesting. Anne in Wexford got in touch. She said, I only spray perfume on my clothes because I was told when you spray it on your skin, the body treats it as a poison and needs to get rid of it. I don't know about that now.
Well, I don't know about treating it as a poison. I mean, natural essential oils were developed by plants as a defense mechanism to stop insects eating them and things like that. So in that sense, you could call it that. But I think spraying it on your skin allows it to evolve with your skin type and with your body chemistry. And so it gives a sort of deeper, more interesting effect, if you like, than just spraying it on your clothes. But spraying it on your clothes is something that people do if they're very sensitive to perfume.
Great. What about on your hair? Does it last longer on your hair?
I mean, there are special hair perfumes that you can get now, so that can be an affordable way of wearing an expensive perfume, because they're often cheaper.
Cheaper. Yeah. Actually, that's a good point, just to Sarah here in studio, because obviously you're writing all the time about beauty, Sarah, and the gloss. You're writing about perfumes an awful lot. And I know you've got a big event coming up in Brown Thomas, do you?
We do, on Wednesday in the evening, 5:30, at Brown Thomas. It's a fragrance masterclass. So we have a perfume expert over from the UK, and we have the Chanel fragrance expert, and we're going to be talking about Comet, which is the latest Chanel Les exclusive scent.
Sarah Halliwell from The Gloss and Sadie Chowan from Burren Perfumery chatting to Maura Duran this morning. Finally, we love a good TV and film recommendation slot here on Playback Daily. And for the watch list this week, Áine Kerr was joined by Gráinne Humphreys, director of the Dublin International Film Festival, and Dave O'Callaghan, host of Here and Back Again podcast.
So, Gráinne, we're going first to Becoming Karl Lagerfeld, which is coming on Disney Plus on June 7th. Do you have to know much about the designer, the glamour, to be able to buy into the story and fashion?
Not at all. It's basically, I suppose, in a way, a kind of origin story. It's about the early years. Although early years in this case are in his 30s, when, you know, he was a ready-to-wear expert, if you like, in Paris, but was still watching, if you like, the rise of Yves Saint Laurent, his kind of a peer that had gone soaring ahead of him. And the period is probably from the early 1970s to very, very early 80s. And it basically, it's an amazing show about rivalry, about competitiveness, about creativity, about being a German man living in Paris with your mother and trying to, if you like, realize the skill and the ambition that you have inside, and all the different ways that he manipulates, if you like, his way into, you know, becoming Karl Lagerfeld. The other side to it is it's also been a menage a trois between Yves Saint Laurent, Karl Lagerfeld, and Jacques de Bacher, who's a kind of dandy character who floats between them. But it's fantastic. I mean, Andy Warhol drops in, Marlene Dietrich drops in. There's multiple kind of purse-off moments where you see people purse their lips and look at each other and stares, withering conversation at the catwalk. Brilliant. Really, so really enjoyable.
The characters are good. The glamour, it compares well, because there's been a lot of these documentaries and movies about the various different fashion houses.
John Galliano, the Kevin MacDonald was probably the most recent one. And I hadn't seen 70s Paris. I've seen New York's in the 70s. London, I think, we're very familiar with. Dublin in the 70s. But this is a really particular kind of world. But it is also about the level of stress that these guys go through to deliver for their sponsors and for their patrons.
OK, that's a thumbs up for you. So Under the Bridge, also Disney Plus. Dave, you're going to take us through this one, starting on Wednesday, June 12th.
Yes, this is based on a true story set in the 90s in Canada and stars Lily Gladstone from Killers of the Flower Moon and Riley Keough, who people might remember from Daisy Jones and the Six. It's the story of a 14-year-old girl, Rena Virk, who goes to a party to join with her friends and never comes home. And this 8-episode kind of thriller mystery is all about the trauma and the tension as the cops accuse these 7 girls about what happened. You don't know what's happened fully. It's slowly revealed. And the cops refer to these girls as Bics, and they do that because they're all from broken homes and living care, and like lighters, they're disposable. That's how the cops, so you can imagine this kind of thing going on, just they naturally assume they've done something bad. It's absolutely fantastic. It's based on a non-fiction best-selling book by Rebecca Godfrey, and Riley Keough plays that character in the book, and it's her story, and the two leads are just absolutely brilliant. And Vritika Gupta, who plays Rena, the young girl, is also amazing. Like, if you like the recent True Detective, if you take that and take away the woo-woo.
Okay, so for those of us who can't do scary things.
Yeah, if you take out the woo-woo crazy stuff in True Detective and just have a good thriller, absolutely edge your seat, dark, gripping and stressful. This is it. So Under the Bridge starts on Wednesday on Disney Plus, and I'd highly recommend it.
Okay, great. Gráinne, you're going to take us through Four Little Adults. This is on the big screen. I think it's coming to the IFI and Lighthouse and some other selected cinemas around the country.
Well, if the Lagerfeld is kind of, you know, a version of Fassbender, this is probably more Ingmar Bergman territory. So it's a really interesting kind of four-hander, I suppose, in which a couple, a politician and a priest, are happily married in Helsinki, or so we think, or so one of them thinks, until they find out that there's actually been a long-standing affair. And so an open marriage is proposed. And the film kind of follows that kind of like fallout, if you like, of how the kind of marriage changes and evolves and moves, and the different partners get pulled into it. But it's, you know, it's counter programming to, you know, most kind of like, you know, the kind of action somewhere, I suppose, that we've had, in that it's a very delicate kind of relationship film, and beautifully acted, beautifully directed, and well worth catching.
Okay, so a nice antidote to the summer blockbusters. Staying with cinemas, David, you've been taking a look at The Watch. This is the new film set in Ireland, directed by M. Night. Shyamalan's daughter is Shana, and hopefully I haven't absolutely butchered that, but you you'll correct me now, David. Tell us more.
Yeah, so it's about 28-year-old artist Mina, who here is played by Dakota Fanning, gets stranded in a creepy forest in Western Ireland. And by the way, Ireland looks great. If you're going to get caught in a creepy forest, this is the place to be. She comes across a stranger in the woods, Georgina Campbell, and she follows her, and then suddenly she's trapped in this kind of weird giant room slash cabin with a glass thing where they just like, stand here, don't move, they're watching us. And you're like, what is going on? So that's the first hour. It looks beautiful. It's got a fantastic eerie score. But the thing with an M Night and an Ishana Night is, as we all know, if the final act doesn't deliver, if the reveal and the is meh, well, then everything becomes a bit meh. And sadly, when you get to the big reveal, you're like, really?
It left you wanting more.
It's very predictable. It's been done better, I suppose. And, you know, it's not really a horror. It's more of a thriller. And if you're going to the movie you watched in the trailer, you're not going to the same movie because it's not a horror movie. It's just kind of, yeah, it's fine. There you go.
Worst review.
People are rushing to the cinema right now. I've always wanted to see a fine movie, but it's fine.
Okay.
That's all it
not
is.
Not a thumbs up, not
fan.
A thumbs down. It's kind
grand.
Of.
Yeah, it's not cute either. But anyway, okay. Right.
The Matrix, Grainne, this is not what I thought would be back in cinemas at a proper big screen experience. Is it worth it?
I thought it was. I really enjoyed myself. I mean, I think the thing about it is that there's a part of me that it's very nostalgic. I go back to when I saw it before. I do think that there's a really interesting thing that's happened in sci-fi that I'm not a huge sci-fi person. And I remember watching this going, this is so complicated. There's so many different layers. I could be getting lost here. And I feel like since then, a lot of those stories have entered into streaming. We're more familiar with complicated lines, right? But the action sequences, I thought, stood up. I thought Neo was still fab. Trinity was still great. Agent Smith, who was obviously here on stage with Hugo Weaving, was wonderful. And yeah, I just think it's still got lots to give. And again, that idea, small screen is lovely, but it doesn't actually come close to the same experience of sitting there and that bullets are flying past you to the back of the cinema. That is where you need
to be. Okay, that's The Matrix, a new restoration back in cinemas nationwide. David, you've been looking at Geek Girl on Netflix. Now, this is a series that hasn't been without its controversies around its depiction of autism. How did you find it?
I adored it. I thought it was I really liked the Holly Smail books. I think they were huge, like there's six in that series and they're brilliant. And the Emily Carey, who plays the, people might remember, she played Lady Melisande Hightower in House of the Dragon. She is fantastic as this socially awkward 16-year-old with limited circle of friends, and then she gets plucked out and becomes the fashion geek chic and all that. I think the interaction between the friends is really well treated. I thought it was all handled very well. And you're obviously going to always get controversy, but it's cute, it's funny. I binged it. I was up, finished it at 1 o'clock last night.
Like, that's the review.
Thank you for your service.
Geek boy had it. No, it's really cute. What was everybody giving out?
We were
about?
Geeking like, out in elections. You geeked out.
It's kind of a younger,
quirkier
version of Heartstopper. You know, it's kind of. Damn it, it's cute.
Okay,
it's just a
great
cute show.
That's a thumbs up rather than a fine.
Grainne Humphreys, director of the Dublin International Film Festival, and Dave O'Callaghan, the host of Here and Back Again podcast, chatting to Áine Kerr about all the TV shows and films you just must watch over the next few days, if you have time. Well, that's all we have time for here on Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.